Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Dreams of a Missouri college education have undocumented immigrant students tossing and turning today. More on that in just a couple of moments. But first, the media and the Ferguson story. How well did local, regional, and national media do in covering that story? It's been the subject of a lot of discussion and self-examination for the past year. Joining us in studio, Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and Kelsey Proud, digital innovation editor here at St. Louis Public Radio, a graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Thanks, folks, so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Hi.
And Bill,
Hi.
Bill, you're wearing your other hat this time,
right.
not the lawyer's hat necessarily. let me start with you, Bill, with regard to a quick assessment of how well you think media did overall in covering the Ferguson story.
Well, I think overall they did some things very well and some things very poorly. And that's true, I think, of the national, local, and social media. The overall impact and the most important one, which is a plus, is that all the coverage has drawn this national and even sometimes international attention to a really serious problem that has existed in St. Louis and a lot of other cities around the country for years. I mean, race writ large, and specifically the relations between African Americans and police departments. I mean, it's led to the Ferguson Commission locally. It's led to the the President's Commission on Policing nationally. Led to the Missouri Legislature's passage of this limitation on how much municipal courts can collect in fines, how much municipalities can collect in fines from their municipal courts. So that's all on the plus side. On the minus side, I would say that. For months, especially the national media portrayed this story based upon what turned out to be pretty much of a myth, that there had been a white police officer who had shot an unarmed African-American youth on his way to who was about to go off to college. And the young man had had his hands up saying, don't shoot. And that was pretty much demolished by the testimony before the grand jury and the Justice Department report last March, which found that that didn't happen. I think the Washington Post eventually rated it as four Pinocchios for not very believable. I've been a little surprised actually at this most recent, as we've come around to the 1 year anniversary, that Dorian Johnson, who was very much the companion of Michael Brown, who was very much responsible for the some of the testimony relating to that myth, has there's been a lot of attention to his story again, almost as if we sort of missed the fact that it conflicts with important physical and forensic evidence. We can probably talk about social media more. That's more than you wanted, probably.
No. We'll definitely talk about that. Kelsey, let me get your take on you look at it from a somewhat different angle because social media is your thing. Your take on the last year.
Well, it's been pretty incredible. There's been a lot of comparison between what happened in Ferguson and the, I would say, the method and sort of the proliferation that happened in social media, similar to the Arab Spring. And I would say that that's a fairly accurate depiction of how quickly things spread, how much people relied on social media and continue to rely. I mean, this is ongoing. This is not over. And this, you know, people continue to rely on it as a primary communication device. Journalists, both local, national, international, who wanted to be part of this conversation, who may not have been on Twitter before or in social media before this incident, found that in order to be even remotely relevant, they had to be there. And that changed some hearts and minds, I think, in journalism. And I think, you know, in some ways for the better. In other ways, you know, I work in it day in, day out. I'm steeped in social media, but I do realize its pitfalls. And it, you know, there are many ways for falsehoods to be spread very quickly. And I've maintained that it's not only the duty of the modern journalist to put out truth as best as they know it, but transparently to put out truth, say how they know it, and then also to try to correct falsehood when they see it. And I think the past year, perhaps there wasn't enough of correcting of the falsehoods. And there was a lot of, you know, as always, there was a lot of pressure to be first rather than right. And that may have contributed to some issues. But overall, I think it was a really powerful tool that completely changed the way that people see modern social movements.
But not everybody using that tool is a journalist per se. A lot of people use it, including people who might have an agenda. And sometimes it's got to be difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to that.
It is. It is. And that's where this was also important to, in my work, to recognize that important sources on this didn't always come in a suit and tie or with a title, because people of influence don't necessarily fall into that category. We saw people who were able to resonate their message very well on social media and became leaders in the sort of new sort of protest movement, and you know, local political figures who use the tool well, like, you know, like an Antonio French, became sort of must know people on their opinions during this. So it was difficult to separate the wheat and the chaff, as you say. But it's also important. It was important to me, and it still remains important to me, to make sure that we're representing a variety of perspectives in the community, not just those of people in traditional power structures. And that is very important to me, so that people have a full picture of opinion that's going on.
Bill, your take on that? I mean, media has changed an awful lot, and just almost minute by minute, but certainly in the last 5 years, 10 years.
Right. Certainly, 10 years ago, I would never have imagined that I would spend last night watching two live streams from different sources and reading people's, you know, looking at various tweets by traditional journalists, so-called citizen journalists, and just activists in the protests to try to keep track of what was going on. I mean, Kelsey did just an amazing job of moderating and picking out the believable tweets amongst the what millions that eventually went across the screen. I mean, if you looked at hashtag Ferguson on a computer screen during the big days of stories, it would go back. It would go by you faster than you could read it. You would have to click on it to stop it and read it. But you know, as it does have a lot of downsides. Like one of the most well known Ferguson live streamers, I think his name is Basim Masri. You know, if you watch his live streams, and if you perchance hear from the audience lots of invective and profanity, it's coming from him. Last night I was watching Revolutionary Z, I think is his name, a Revolutionary X, who was doing live streaming. He's a self-described citizen journalist from Chicago. And, you know, he was, of course, including his commentary, which was, you know, the police had really blown it by arresting people sort of randomly at the end of the night. So, you know, there's no way in which these people you can really expect any kind of like balance or fairness or you know, what we once called objectivity, or still call objectivity. But it's, so that's why jobs like Kelsey's are so important, to try to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Has social media in the digital age taken over journalism, do you think? I mean, you know, we know what's happening with newspapers. We know what television, particularly local television and cable television, do these days. Do we have to turn away from that, do you think? And are we?
I would say in some ways it really has taken over. I mean, all of the news in Ferguson was first reported on Twitter. And, of course, all of the false rumors were first reported on Twitter. I mean, when we put out a story, when any news organization puts out a story – One of the most important things is how many people are going to see it. And so you want to tweet it, and you want to make sure that it's retweeted and that it gets posted on various sites. News organizations are constantly looking at how many hits has this particular piece of journalism gotten. So the social media comes in, both in the collecting of the information sometimes and then in getting the story out and trying to have impact with the story.
And Kelsey, this business of retweeting brings with it issues in and of itself.
Yeah, somewhat. I think I'll just say that the majority of what I was doing over the past year has been retweeting. I think it's a blatant falsehood that retweeting something is an endorsement. And there are different thoughts on that, but I really think it's a blatant falsehood. I think it's passing it along. It's the same as quoting someone in a story. It doesn't mean that the writer of that story agrees with what was said. They are just reporting what was said. And that is the best method so that it is as transparent and clear to the reader of those tweets where that came from. To me, retweeting is almost better because it attaches an authorship to a comment rather than it being sort of left up to individual citation.
But a number of news organizations have ethical problems with that, figuring that if you're retweeting false information, that, of course, becomes a major issue.
Sure. I mean, when things were going so quickly, I mean, I looked back at some of our statistics and I was kind of shocked at what I read and what I saw in the numbers. There were points in August of 2014 that I was tweeting like three times a minute. Or retweeting three times a minute, and I checked the math like five times, and it was right. And I was kind of shocked. So I was having to make very, very fast split second decisions. And sometimes that was just the method was passing along information. And that's why I was retweeting, so that people would know where that information came from. It's a tough balance.
So you are really an editor and a fact checker at the same time.
Well, sort of. It's sort of a hybrid. The fact checking thing, there's in the speed at which it was moving, there was absolutely no way to fact check everything that was happening. Absolutely no way. It was basically the onus was on us to determine which sources we could trust in whole, and then to pass along that information to the best of our ability. It's dicey. So we knew that, and users of that system know it as well.
Are you comfortable with that, Bill? I mean, going back to the day, if you will, and that's not day is not too long ago. You did have the fact checkers and the editors.
Yes. Well. I'm comfortable with it when Kelsey's doing it. I don't know if I would be comfortable with it in every situation. And
no.
I'm sitting here as if I put my law hat back on. I'm sitting here asking myself, if you retweet something that's false, could you be sued that has a libelous untruth in it? Could you be sued for libel? And I guess I think not, but it's ethically, you don't want, as a journalist, you don't want to spread false information or rumor. I mean, one way in which social media came into play, in particular in this Michael Brown shooting, was that it became right after the shooting, in the hours after the shooting, it became one of the ways in which false rumors and false supposed eyewitness accounts were spread. The Justice Department got its hands on the iPad that had been used to record those Jefferson County contractors, one of whom threw his arms up in the air. And somebody, after recording that, which turned out to be a very misleading video, put the iPad down. It was collecting all sorts of witnesses, people who said they had seen the shooting, and here's what they had seen, and sort of like passing information back and forth. And the FBI said none of that, very little of what they heard on the iPad of these supposed eyewitnesses talking about what they had seen, squared with physical and forensic evidence of what had happened.
I have to take a break. We'll do that now. We're talking about how the media handled the Ferguson story over the course of the last year. And, of course, The media, once again, is very heavily involved because of what's happened over the last couple of days. My guests in studio are Kelsey Proud, digital innovation editor here at St. Louis Public Radio, and Bill Freivogel, who is a journalism professor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. We'll take some calls. If you have questions or comments concerning media coverage, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back to Bill Freivogel and Kelsey Proud. You know, it's easy, I suppose, to use social media as something of a target in a discussion like this. But one of the things that I think we have to point out also is there were a lot of journalists from someplace else who, as we say, parachuted into Ferguson to cover the story, and also were guilty of a lot of misinformation that went unchecked and went national immediately through the cable networks in particular. I saw that, Bill, as a real problem for the Ferguson story.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, I think Ferguson itself was sort of mischaracterized as what kind of town it was. You know, in general, Ferguson is actually most of Ferguson is a very well integrated community. I mean, certainly St. Louis itself is a very racially segregated community, is based on housing, but
except for the Ferguson Police Department, we might add.
Right? Except for the Ferguson, yeah. That's true. You know, and then of course there were all these sort of misstate, you know, anonymous that anarchist group had the wrong shooter, the wrong police department. Fox News said that Wilson's jaw had been broken by, or eye socket had been broken by Brown. There were just all sorts of distortions. One of the very best, you know, one of the best pieces I've heard on this year anniversary is by Nicole Hannah Jones. She did a thing for This American Life on desegregation, basically on the Normandy School District, yeah, and how it became unaccredited, and the you know, talked to a number of the parents and children who were caught up in all that, and but even she, a very good reporter, at some point in her broadcast, she says that the St. Louis school district, the broader St. Louis desegregation transfer program, was killed by state officials in 1999. You know, quite the contrary. Mm-hmm. State officials continued it after 1999, and it's still alive. 5,000 students are in it. So even some of the best reporters who came in didn't have all the information that they needed to paint the right picture.
And some of them, particularly on cable networks that I was familiar with, really painted a distorted picture. And it seemed like they had an agenda. They wanted the story to turn out a certain way and kind of steered it in that direction. Anything to add to that, Kelsey? I'm going to go to the phones.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, it was frustrating for me because we work very hard locally to make sure that we get the details right. And it was very frustrating for us to see journalists sort of come in with almost no research and had done very little homework on the region, confusing things as basic as the fact that there's a St. Louis city and there's a St. Louis county, that basic. And that was very tough for us to reconcile when we try very hard, because we know that we have to stay here and we will be held accountable by members of the community because we're part of the community.
And we have to point at ourselves as local journalists as well, because I think a lot of journalists in St. Louis were caught by surprise by the Ferguson story and should have realized that this was nothing new, what's been going on out
Correct.
There. It's been going on for a great many years, and the context just wasn't there, which I think is – I don't want to use the word shameful, but I'll use the word shameful.
Yeah, we didn't look in the mirror.
Exactly. Let's take a couple of calls. Ron is calling from Ferguson. He's been very patient. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I want to thank your guests. I think they had a very good insight on some of the issues. I think overall this was some of the worst coverage in journalism I've ever seen. If you wanted to write a story, if you should first start at Florissant Valley Community College and just drive from one end of Ferguson to another, And if you met people there, you would find I've spent a lot of years in the military where I've had the least amount of racial tension in Ferguson than anywhere. The people there get along. 95% of the people that were arrested for rioting didn't live there. Most of the protesters don't live there. Then you got an alderman from St. Louis who comes from one of the most depressed areas in the region speaking for Ferguson, which is really ridiculous, and people putting him on CNN asking him what he has to say in his area is 10 times more depressed. Mike Brown didn't live in Ferguson, and nor did Darren Wilson. One reporter in American wrote that most of the businesses in Ferguson were burnt down by the owners. There's no evidence of that. The Justice Department did a horrible job. They put out statistics that talked about the number of African-Americans getting tickets there, but it was almost parallel with the number of African-Americans that lived there. Somebody should have hired a statistician and looked at that crap because it was a waste of time and money. There were some problems with the police department, and I'm glad that some of them are being resolved. But, I would like to see some follow-up of what's happening with these looters that were arrested. What type of sentencing are they getting, and why are they starting to let people out on their own recognizance instead of making post-bail?
Ron, thank you.
The whole idea of civil disobedience is you have to pay the price to be disobedient.
Ron, thank you for the call. You gave us all plenty to chew on. Anyone want to comment on Ron's?
Well, I would agree with a lot of what he said about Ferguson being a much different community than it was portrayed. I would disagree with him about the Justice Department report on the Ferguson Police Department. I mean, I read the whole report as I reported on it for St. Louis Public Radio, and it almost turned my stomach. I felt sick at the end of the day reading about all of the examples of racist and unconstitutional police practices that were occurring in Ferguson. And I think probably are occurring in thousands of police departments around the country that just have not been under the same kind of microscope as Ferguson was. And I think even though I see a point about the statistics, that the statistics on the effect on African Americans in Ferguson were pretty appalling.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Let's take a call from Patrick in Wentzville. Patrick, go ahead, please.
Okay, I think the real problem, the reason that people are relying so much on social media, which is unedited and unfact-checked, is because most people feel that the American institution of journalism that is vacant. It's empty. It's void. There are four media companies in the country that control all news broadcasting. And frankly, there's no one's asking the deep questions. Nobody is taking the story and spending time working on it. They're moving from headline to headline because they're worried about ratings. And then even on local news, you're seeing, oh, coming up next, the lead story is who's on Dances with the Stars. It's not journalism anymore.
Thanks very much for the call. I would take exception to his comment with regard to this station, because what we are able to do here that others don't and can't is detail and take time to develop stories. But I'm not the one to answer the question.
Well, I agree with you, Don, but I think the caller has a point that journalism is held in very low regard by the American people. Mm-hmm. I think if you do surveys of students about what job they would like to have, journalist is very low down on the totem pole, and people just don't. They may trust journalists more than they trust politicians, but that's not saying very much. The one good thing about social media is it's an incredible democratizing force on media. Everybody can say what they want to say. Yeah, and yes, it's unedited, and yes, it's full of false statements, conspiracy theories, and rumors. It's also full of new information and different perspectives that maybe no journalist was coming up with. So it actually gives us, my overall, even though I'm very critical of some things, overall, social media gives us these tools we never had before to tell the story. And it's way more complicated now for listeners and for news consumers to figure out where to find the information they can trust. But it does give us way more tools to tell the story.
It also does bring, once again, media literacy, and it's a different it's a different approach now. We do it with newspapers and ads and all the rest of it, and political advertising. Now we have to learn how to do that with regard to the social media, Kelsey.
Yeah, we sure do. That is, I'll go back to my point about what we really try to do here. And when I talk to others who do the job similar to what I do across the country, those of us who feel we're doing it the best we can are being extremely transparent about what we know, how we know it, and just, you know, being very clear. It's when news organizations obscure where they know things or are not transparent that we start to run into problems, and you start to, feed into that distrust that we talked about. And so in the height of things in August, September, November of last year, we tried to be very clear that it was, number one, it was a human being behind our Twitter account. It was me or one of my colleagues most of the time. We tried to be very clear that we were hearing what they said. We tried to be blatant in thanking them for their trust, and we promised them that we would share what we know, what we knew, when we knew it, and share how we knew it. And I think we've lived up to that, and that's something that's important.
I'm going to take one more call. Our time is just about up, but we'll bring in Craig calling from St. Louis. I think he wants to get something off his chest about me or something I said. Go ahead, Craig.
Hi, Donna. I apologize that it was presented that way. It makes me very uncomfortable.
Don't be uncomfortable.
I'm already prejudiced by what you said without even what I'm going to say. You've already precluded that I'm going to say something derogatory against you.
Well, not necessarily. But go ahead, Craig. Get to the point, please.
No, it is necessary because you just said that. So I find it very difficult to be able to make a statement in a neutral way.
Well, I wish you'd go ahead and make it because our time is getting away from us, Greg.
So now you're going to use the excuse of time and avoid what I'm addressing.
I just wish you'd get to whatever it is you want to say.
So you don't want to address the fact that you just discriminated against me before I could even say anything.
Greg, you're going to get to the point.
So you... That's fine. I think the public sees that you don't want to address the fact that you just discriminated against me,
Craig,
for a position that you don't even know I have.
I'll give you one more chance. Get to the point and do it now, or I'm going to have to move along.
You know, I've got a background in journalism. I've got a background in intelligence. I've written a lot of articles in the context of both. It's unfortunate that the journalism profession doesn't have a certification. We're not considered credible, unless it's unfortunate. And there are a lot of people that write articles, and the things that you're talking about are true. Things get out online, and they're not validated, verified. If I were to write an article as an intel analyst and not verify my sources, I'd be written up for violating the secrecy laws and revealing information that is of a higher classification if I didn't verify my sources. That's the first thing I learned in journalism school at Eastern Illinois University in the 70s. However, that is a fact that everybody knows. Everybody knows that. And everybody's trying their best. And in this day and age, there's so much communication that any falsehoods or any reference to articles or reference to individual statements are borne out by the facts, and just as with this incident. However, I'm an advocate of NPR, public radio. It's the most balanced approach that I've seen of any news organization. And I recommend you, Don, for your intent and the overall perspective of trying to present the issue. However, I must be honest. If you do like a journalism student would do and look at every single program that you've had over the last year and add up all the people and identify their advocacy, you've had far more programs associated with one side rather than the other. And now you can come back and make an excuse that you've invited people to come and talk, and they have refused to. It still doesn't negate the responsibility to put both sides of the issue on the program. And then, unfortunately, a few months after that, and I listened articulately. I used to be an employee of Dr. Suggs, and I thought he was very commendable in the way he tried to approach the issue when he was on your show. I'm very proud of him for the way he approached it, and I have a lot of respect for him. Unfortunately, I'm very upset that at one point during the process of several months, you addressed the individuals in leadership in the community and the police as, now I'm going to use this term, and it's not the term used.
Greg, move along, please. I want to hear what you have to say, but I want you to say it quickly.
Again, it was not necessary for you to say that.
It is, because we have a clock in front of us, Craig, and we have to abide by the clock, unfortunately. I'll tell you what.
Obviously, you're not going to be accountable for anything that is addressed to you.
I'll be more than accountable. I'll be more than accountable. Give me a call when we're off the air, and I'll talk with you all afternoon if you want. But we don't have the time for all of this right now. Sorry. You know, I'll call again tomorrow. Call after the show. We'll do it then. Folks, that's the end of it, I'm afraid, for our segment. Craig took up a little bit too much time. Sorry about that. Kelsey Proud, thank you so much for being with us. Bill Freivogel, sorry about the way this session ended. I'll talk to Craig when the program is over and let him have his say. We have to move along now. And when we come back, we have a wake-up call for dreamers out there. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.